Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchteroin, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the visit of Queen Elizabeth's sister to Ireland in 1965 and the extraordinary chaos and violence that followed. Cold water cures in Cork in the 19th century with the creation of Ireland's first sanatorium. And then to end the show, the novelist Joseph Conrad and the reasons for his profound suspicion of imperial power. You can email us your thoughts and views to talkinghistory@newstalk.com and we'd love to hear from you. And we begin tonight's show with the visit of Princess Margaret. In January 1965, Princess Margaret and her husband, Lord Snowdon, travelled to Abbey Leake's house in County Laois for what was supposed to be a quiet private holiday. Instead, their visit provoked Republican protests, threats, and extraordinary scenes. Trees were felled to block roads and petrol bombs were thrown. Afterwards, arrests led to violent clashes between the Gardaí and demonstrators. The whole episode has largely disappeared from public memory, but is retold in a brilliant new novel. The book is called A House in Winter, published by Eru. The author is Emily Harrigan. Well, Emily, you're very welcome to the show. And can I begin with a question of how you came across this remarkable story? In your afterword, you say you were actually in the archives researching something else.
I was indeed. When you say in the archives, I don't mean that I was digging around among dusty boxes of files, but I was online, the amazing Irish newspaper archive. I was looking up a different story. I was actually following a story about Tony Snowden's, Lord Snowden's mother, Anne, who was Countess of Ross. And I mean, as I read, I came across this. At first, I couldn't really believe it. I was like, surely if the IRA had thrown petrol bombs at Princess Margaret in Ireland, I would know this. You know, this would be something that was kind of generally known. And I was so taken by the idea that this existed and that I'd never come across it, that I just began going further and further into this crazy little story. And at the end of it, I went, wow, was there ever anything that lent itself better to the idea of a novel than this piece of historical background?
It could also have been an episode of The Crown in the way it tells the story of Margaret and Tony and the family and the tensions and the Irish dimension. So for those who aren't familiar with Princess Margaret, okay, Queen Elizabeth's sister and her husband, Lord Snowdon, who were they and why did they come to Abbeleek's house in January 1965?
So the nucleus of this story is Princess Margaret was the sister of Queen Elizabeth. She was at one point in her, well, for most of her young life, she was second in line to the throne. She was obviously a person of great importance. She was also a person of great personality. And the stories of Princess Margaret are legion. The stories of her rudeness, you know, she had like a habit of leaning on royal protocol in order to upset and distress the people around her, or even just, you know, perhaps just to prove her own superiority. For example, things like nobody could begin eating until she had started, and nobody could continue eating after she'd finished. So she would go to dinner and she would sit there, food would be served, she wouldn't eat a thing, she would sit there smoking. And eventually she would lift a fork and the whole table would grab their forks and they would get ready to shovel food into their mouths, because they knew perfectly well she would take two bites and then she would put the fork down and they would all have to do the same thing. So there were all of these funny stories about her. And anyone who's seen The Crown knows that she was this kind of massive personality. And I was always kind of fascinated by her. When she was very young, she had this disappointing affair with Group Captain Peter Townsend. They, you know, couldn't get the royal seal of approval to be married. It never happened. Everybody in England, in the UK, was kind of, you know, poor Margaret, who will she marry? And then eventually she met the photographer, who was Anthony Armstrong Jones was his name. And they had kind of semi-secret, slightly whirlwind, very passionate courtship. They seem to have been completely mad about each other in the beginning. And they got married and he got the title of Lord Snowden. So that is who he was in, you know, the guise in which he appeared in Ireland in 1965. Was far from their first visit. His sister, Susan, was married to Lord de Vici, and they lived at Abbey Leake's house. And his mother, who at that time was, this was her second marriage, she had married Michael Parsons, who was the Earl of Ross. So they lived in Ireland. Tony and Margaret had come over. They'd had a really great visit in 1962, in which they came. You know, they kind of went dashing around the countryside in a little red two-seater car. They stopped and had pints in places. Everybody was happy to see them. They really did seem to enjoy themselves. So 1965, they proposed coming over again. And I think that the Irish state were a little bit iffy about it. It costs a lot of money to have a royal visit, even if it's not a state visit. So, you know, there is security obviously required. And that costs. And I think the feeling was, you know, like, really, do you have to do this again? But he was determined that they were going to do this, you know, that they would visit his sister, that they would stay with her. And, you know, they would try to perhaps recreate the happy circumstances of 1962. So January 1965, they rocked up and they were picked up at Shannon Airport and they were driven to Abbey Leake's house, where his sister and her husband, John de Vici, were waiting to greet them. It is this private visit of Princess Margaret and her husband, who at this stage had been married for 5 years. Things were kind of rocky between them and they pitch up. And due to the, you know, the force majeure of this IRA petrol bomb attack, they ended up trapped inside the house with no electricity for 48 hours.
And that's what I can't understand. If there wasn't the Pathé News footage of what happens afterwards, and if there wasn't the newspaper coverage, I would think this whole thing was made up, because it is extraordinary how something that's a private holiday and it's not an official royal visit, and given the fact that they had visited 3 years earlier and there hadn't been such issues, it's extraordinary to think that this private visit in January 1965 became so controversial and so dangerous.
Yeah, it's really crazy. And as you say, if I hadn't read like the proper chain of events leading up to and then even more kind of dramatically afterwards, I also would question whether this could possibly have happened. But you can see it there. So there are accounts. So a few days before they arrived, it was the Feast of the Epiphany, right, which is January the 6th. And there are newspaper accounts of a sermon preached in Kilkenny Cathedral by a priest called Father Sharon. And he's preaching. So from the pulpit, which, you know, obviously has kind of, you know, time-honoured associations with what we did in this country. From the pulpit, he is preaching this sermon in which he talks about these two young people, as he calls them. And he's kind of likening their visit to, you know, the arrival of the three wise kings going to see Jesus. And, you know, how they have the right at this time of year, as everybody does, to visit their friends and, you know, to kind of renew these bonds. And he is disapproving of what he calls young addleheads who are making a noise and expressing their disapproval at this visit, because there were already leaflets being sent around, you know, no foreign power on Irish soil. Somebody had daubed on the fountain in the middle of Abbey Leaks. Somebody had written, "Royalty and Jones, go home." And so he was picking up, this priest was picking up on all of this, and he was preaching this sermon about, you know, there are certain elements who don't want them and, you know, are trying to reject their right to visit their friends. And he is making this association with the Epiphany and, you know, the three kings. And it's kind of crazy, you know, so there was already kind of a lot of disruption around the idea of their visit even before they arrived. So even though people were turning out and cheering the car, you know, and lining the streets to get a look at the princess, which, you know, is what always happens, there were also then in the background, there was this element of, you know, disruption. And I suppose, like, maybe this was an interesting and possibly slightly irresistible way to make a statement. You know, there she is, the sister of the reigning monarch, right in their midst. And even though, so those petrol bombs did not obviously harm anyone. Otherwise, I suspect we'd know a lot more about them. They were thrown over the wall of the domain. And the first one doesn't seem to have done much damage. But the second one managed to take out power lines and an electricity substation. And that was what plunged the area into darkness. You know, the electricity was out for 48 hours. And then what these elements of the IRA also did was they hacked down trees and huge branches of trees outside the gates so that the road was impassable. So not only did they take out the electricity, but they also trapped them in the house because you couldn't open the gates and drive out through them. So, and there was that night, you know, there's an account in the Times that somebody sent me recently, the Times of London, of the chase that night. So there was a 50-mile car chase and 10 men were arrested. And, you know, there were kind of efforts undergoing immediately to find another, I think they rounded up 15 or 20 of them in total, though they only charged 10 ultimately. So it all kind of happened there and then. It kicked off the very night of their arrival, and the police were involved and in this car chase from the very beginning. And then the aftermath, which we might talk about in a minute, you know, kind of what happened after their departure when the, you know, when the men were taken to the courthouse and arraigned for these crimes. But so that is, you know, so all of these things, as you say, you'd hardly believe it if I hadn't followed the train through all of these newspaper reports from before their arrival to afterwards. I myself would be going, how can it be possible that we don't kind of talk more about this?
And I even love the graffiti there, royalty and Jones go home. They're refusing to give Snowden his title. They're not even calling him Anthony Armstrong Jones. It's simply Jones. Jones go home. There seemed to be a lot of public sympathy for the couple when the petrol bombs were being thrown and they were locked in the house in darkness and all of that. But then once these 10 men were put up in were charged and appeared in court, the sympathy, the public mood seems to have changed. And you have crowds gathering to support them. There's riots then. There's the extraordinary Pathé footage you talk about at the end of the book and how you can look at that on YouTube. It's interesting how public attitudes seem to shift as it goes on.
Isn't it? And of course, I mean, here in Ireland, we have form for that, right? I mean, that is not the first time that that has happened. And in a psychological sense, I can completely see it. You know, in the beginning, the feeling is leave them alone. You know, this is a private visit. This is, you know, a man visiting his sister, a woman visiting her sister-in-law. You know, I mean, like, leave them alone, essentially, I kind of think is what anyone would think. And of course, I mean, we, you know, there was a daily diet because the UK newspapers were available here. Everybody had seen Margaret growing up from a child and, you know, the kind of years of the disappointing love affair. And I would feel that there was probably a degree of interest and affection. But that, of course, changes hugely when people you know or people who are in some way connected to the community in which you live are arrested and are going to be tried with, I think it was damage to property, was what they tried them with in the end. The tone changed. The tone would change. You know, you have these men now who are picked up by the police and who are going to face the consequences of this. And the scenes, I mean, anybody who is interested, I really strongly urge you, go onto YouTube and just type in a combination of, you know, Margaret, January 1965, Ireland, and you will see, I couldn't, like, that was really what for me kind of, I mean, blew my mind. Is that a bit much? Maybe. But I couldn't believe the level of violence and aggression that you see in that Pathé news. So the news cameras are there. Obviously, the fact that the, you know, the kind of target was originally Margaret is what has sent the news reels or the news teams over to capture the aftermath of this. And so there they are, filming. You see the men arriving in a bus and they are taken out of the bus with, you know, fairly strong police presence. And immediately this very large crowd, who were all carrying banners, you know, with the same thing, like, you know, no foreign presence on Irish soil. And there are speeches being made. You know, there are men with megaphones who are making speeches. And almost immediately, the level of violence seems to escalate. There is initially some pushing and shoving. There's obviously a lot of shouting. You know, the police managed to kind of hold back the crowds. They bring them into the courthouse. That arraignment was abandoned because the pressure was so intense from outside. People were hammering at the door. You know, the crowds grew in number. I think more police were drafted in from the surrounding area. And as they then left the courthouse, it all kicked off. There's baton charging. There are people whose heads are being split open. I mean, it's really, you know, there's a good solid, I don't know, is it 5 or 6 minutes that you can watch? And it is really, it is a very violent demonstration. It is close quarter violence. It's, you know, people with fists and batons and, you know, they've kind of, you know, pushed over a car and, you know, picked up, I don't know, bits of wood, anything that can be kind of turned into a weapon from the street. And the crowds and the guards are really going at each other.
And what I love about the book is the way it captures this moment in Irish history when, in a way, the country was at this crossroads. It was the same month where Sean Lamass, the Taoiseach, went to meet Terence O'Neill in Northern Ireland. And you have a change in the relationship between Ireland and Northern Ireland and perhaps with Ireland and Britain. And then at the same time, you see these tensions exposed in people's hearts and minds where there is this ambivalent position towards Britain and the royalty and the royal family, and that what begins with perhaps some cheers and people watching the cars go by, you know, descends into anger and these kinds of tensions.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it interesting? You know, as you say, it begins with, oh, look, isn't she lovely? What is she wearing? And then you scratch the surface and you find that actually deep inside there is a completely different feeling. When you remove the kind of gloss of royalty and, you know, the what is she wearing aspect and, you know, how has she done her hair, very quickly you reach a stage where there is still obviously and understandably a very, very deep sense of a divide between them and us and everything that we may feel that they have done to us and that the crown represents in terms of the relationship between them and us. And the minute it turns nasty, we are so done with the whole, isn't she lovely? What's she wearing? You know, how do they seem to be getting on? You know, what kind of a relationship do these people have? That is no longer of any interest. You are right back in that stage of, you know, there is bad blood still between these two countries. And this is where it comes out. And this is how we look at it. And, you know, I mean, at that stage, and I am no expert on the IRA in the 1960s, but, you know, 1965, this is just 4 years before everything kicks off in the North. And there is then a whole new dimension to the IRA. At this time, you know, am I right there? It's a kind of, I mean, not a low-key force, but, you know, there is no kind of overriding purpose for the IRA that would swing popular sentiment behind them. There are obviously still groups of people who form a network who are the IRA, who are capable, as we see in this incident, of mobilizing and getting things done. You know, I mean, pretty swiftly, it seems, they must have put together a plan that had two dimensions. You know, there are the bombs, the petrol bombs, and then there's also the trees. So, you know, there's enough people, there's enough order within that network to coordinate this and to make it happen and then, you know, to escape. And then also you would assume by the speed of the guard response, you would assume that there's a bit of watching going on. You know, people are still, like, official Ireland is still keeping abreast of what is going on within this network and, you know, what the remnants are doing and what they're planning. So I think, I mean, for me, it is just, as you say, exactly, it is this incredible microcosm of where Ireland was at the time, the relationship with the UK. I mean, the personalities and the psychology of it are what I kind of delve into inside the house and in the novel. But all of that background is what drew me to it in the first place.
You mention a story in your afterword about how it's said that when Tony contracted polio when he was 16, he was hospitalised for 6 months and his mother never visited him once. So she's a wonderful character to add to what was already a remarkably tense environment, both for what's happening outside and inside, and then throw her into the mixture and it becomes even more combustible.
Well, I couldn't resist. So I have done, you know, she was not in the truest terms of historical accuracy. Anne Ross was not there. I think it's fair to do that as long as you do not present it as fact. She is so interesting. So her mesmerizing personality is what sent me into the archives in the first place. And her relationship with Tony, I have always found very interesting. You know, there's this kind of sort of shade between them that hints at all the ways in which his relationship with his mother is said to have been very difficult, that she was quite a withholding figure in his life, that he constantly sought her approval and her affection, and that these things seemed to be in short supply for him. And indeed, that story, he contracted polio, was in hospital for 6 months. I mean, he walked with a limp for the rest of his life. In hospital, apparently he was visited by everybody, including Marlene Dietrich. He was a very amusing young man. And his mother never, ever visited in the 6 months that he was sick. And it's given always as one of the building blocks of, you know, Tony's psychology and the way in which his relationship with Margaret was also rather difficult. You know, that here's the kind of backstory to it. I mean, look, I've not heard the story contradicted. But then I have also heard another side to her. You know, there was a second marriage, there was a second family. It seems that she was, you know, a loving and affectionate mother. And these two things are possible. People are complicated, you know. I mean, circumstances change, personalities change, dynamics change. It is possible that both things are true. I think that makes her more interesting. And there was always this story that I found very funny about apparently Princess Margaret never told her mother-in-law what to call her. So protocol demands that it's ma'am followed by your royal highness. Unless you are told specifically by, in this case, Princess Margaret, that you can call her something else, you have to stick with protocol. And apparently she never did tell Anne that she could call her something else. And so she was stuck with calling her dear because it was the only way that she could, you know, get around the slight snub. So she only called her dear, and that this added this kind of edge between them, and that there were all of these, you know, these kind of one-upmanship games between them. Obviously, protocol is all on Margaret's side, but at the same time, Anne had this massive personality and, you know, the habit of being first, I think, with everybody who knew her was just the kind of natural order of things for her. So when the two of them are in the same house at the same time, there is this kind of silent jockeying for position.
Well, a forgotten and yet a very dramatic episode of Irish history. The book is called A House in Winter. It's published by Eru. The author is Emily Harrigan. And Emily, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. The St Anne's Hill Hydropathic Establishment, or the Hydro, was Ireland's first and preeminent sanatorium. The Hydro was built in County Cork in 1843 and closed its doors 110 years later. Founded by Sir Richard Barter and run by three generations of his family, only ruins remain on a hill between Tower and Blarney. But a new book tells the story of the Hydro's history, bringing together a range of sources and including how it became a site of medical innovation. The book is called Ireland's First Sanatorium, The St Anne's Hill Hydro, County Cork, 1843 to 1953. The authors are Sinead McSweeney and Ronan Foley. It's published in paperback by Four Courts Press as part of the Maynooth Studies in Local History series. And I'm delighted to welcome Ronan Foley to the show tonight. Ronan, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Patrick, and thanks for inviting me in.
So tell us about the Hydro, why it was established and why its creation was so remarkable.
Well, there was a great craze in the kind of starting in the 1830s for hydrotherapy, kind of started in Europe. There was a place called Greifenberg, which is now in Czechia, which became a kind of a famous centre for hydrotherapy treatment. People went there in large numbers. And that model kind of got exported all across Europe and got to Britain and ultimately to Ireland as well. So the key man here is Dr. Richard Barter. He was a trained, qualified doctor working in Central Cork in Inishkara. And he got very interested in hydrotherapy, and he essentially went over to Britain, looked at some of the hydros there, and then brought the model back to Ireland. So it's kind of this constant movement of a kind of a medical model.
And that famous phrase, of course, taking the waters. But I hadn't quite realised that taking the waters in Cork and in the hydro was really quite so advanced and really quite sophisticated cold water curative regime.
It was pretty intense stuff, yeah. And there was a very much a regime. You know, people would go to the hydro for anything from a couple of months to sometimes up to a year. So people went there for a long stay. They had a very kind of curative regime, as you say, where they would typically take baths in the morning. There would be shower baths, douche baths, sitz baths, all sorts of different types of baths. And then sometimes they would take a cold water sheet, wrap themselves up in that. And the aim ultimately was kind of to sweat profusely and expel all the toxins from the body. That's the gist of it, really.
And some of the treatments, including the diets and the exercise and the emphasis on hygiene and preventative health, you know, these are all quite modern. And I wonder, though, at the time, were these seen as quackery and were these seen as far too eccentric and impractical?
Yeah, I think both of those things are true. I think in one way they were way ahead of their time because it was very much a holistic treatment. It was not just about taking the water, it was about diet, about exercise. And the grounds were deliberately designed to kind of support sort of people walking in very nice tree-lined walks. But it absolutely was considered quackery. And over a number, in the early years of the hydro, Barter was accused of being a sort of mad doctor, a bit of a quack. He himself was actually a trained medical doctor, an orthodox doctor, but there was this sense of unorthodox medicine against orthodox medicine. And probably for exactly the same reasons people do it today, people turn to unorthodox medicine when they're not happy with orthodox medicine. And that was the case, as much the case in 1840 as it can be in 2026.
Now, it developed remarkably quickly and it did attract patients. So I'm just wondering, how expensive was it to go to it and who were the patients who went there?
It was around £2, 2 shillings, or £2 up to 10 shillings, depending on extra treatments that you would have signed up for, which at the time was very expensive, given very low daily wages and weekly wages. The kinds of people who went to tended to be the Anglo-Irish aristocracy in the first instance and the professional classes. So it started out, it actually got very heavily promoted by Richard Beamish, who was one of the Cork brewing family. He was a good friend of Barter's and was one of the first patients there. And there was a lot of selling by patients, almost, if you like, you know, the kind of testimonials of well-established and well-known patients kind of spread the reputation of the cure. And of course, accounts in the press and in travellers' accounts of actual cures and people, you know, feeling much better from their rheumatism or from various digestive disorders after a good long stay at the hydro.
And it's not just the story of the doctors and the wealthy patients. It's also the story of the substantial workforce, because you had nurses and bath attendants and domestic servants and agricultural labourers and tradesmen. So there's a huge workforce involved in keeping the hydro running.
Absolutely. And it was a huge local employer in the Tower and Blarney area and very much valued for that. But absolutely. And often At its kind of height, the number of workers probably exceeded the number of guests by about 2 to 1. You had very much this kind of medical staff. You had what you might call indoor staff, which was cooks and chefs, and then you had outdoor staff we were looking after. So, for example, the hydro had its own, again, well ahead of its time, almost an organic farm, where the food literally was forked to table, you know, or sort of garden to table from within the hydro's own grounds. There were various chefs over the years, one of whom was actually Bob Geldof's great-grandfather, Zenon Geldof, was worked there for a couple of years. And just a whole kind of, if you like, industry. It's like a colony which had its own supporting thing. One of the things we write in the book about this idea of it looked very serene on the cover for the guests, but the typical, like a duck, you know, paddling furiously underneath, and this network of people moving around making sure that the guests were happy and keeping things going.
Well, speaking of celebrities and famous people who attended, there's a tradition that Charlie Chaplin stayed there, Paul Robeson as well, that it did attract people from around the world.
It did. And over time, really, you know, it sort of morphed a bit from being a long-term residential to more of a short-term stay place. And then it ultimately had a kind of a, I suppose, a hotel or a fancy kind of spa hotel edge to it as well. Chaplin used to go to Parkness Hill a lot, as people are probably well aware of, but he stopped off in the Hydro regularly. Edmund Carson was a regular visitor. There was a lot of links with the legal profession in the Hydro. And actually, my co-author Sinead's grandfather met Paul Robeson, shook his hand and said it was the proudest day in his life.
God, incredible. So what about the ideas that the Hydro is associated with, ideas about temperance and moral as well as physical improvement? That were the people who went there being offered a new or a different philosophy of how people ought to live?
Yes and no. I mean, the Victorian era was, you know, well known for its kind of morality, I suppose, and temperance was a big part of that. So the no alcohol, with one or two little exceptions, crossed the Hydro's path until the 1930s. So all through its life, temperance was part of it. But it was part of that sort of living a good life, drinking water. Water was seen not just in terms of its curative potential, but also as a kind of hygienic and morally acceptable cure. They even tried to wean people off tea and coffee when they went there first. So that sort of medico-moral component to it was quite important. There's a downside to that too, was very kind of managing people's behaviours, making sure nobody smuggled anything in. They did, by all accounts, people did smuggle alcohol in. And there was a thing called sort of going for a shave, which meant people would have boiling water brought up to their rooms where they had little toddies of rum and they'd make themselves punch at night. So there's all these kind of little stories. But in general, that alcohol-free environment lasted through most of the Hydro's life.
Now, they were also quite innovative in another way, that they developed a new type of Turkish bath, and this proved so successful and popular that they exported it around the world.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the really amazing parts of the story, that Richard Barter had got very interested initially in hydrotherapy and then had met a man called David Urquhart, who was a great advocate for, so very kind of like influencers of their day. And Urquhart arrived with a great passion for hammams, the traditional kind of Ottoman bath and Turkish bath. And they thought they'd try and redevelop a new version of it. So they experimented over a number of years, sometimes quite unsuccessfully, sometimes successfully. He sent his friend, who was also called Richard Barter, there are many Richard Barters in this story, to Rome to look at the design of the old hypocaust and the Roman baths. And then they produced this hybrid version that was patented and then exported all over the rest of Ireland, to Britain and to and ultimately back to Germany, rather strangely.
And a question then about why it closed. Did attitudes change, or did fashions change, or belief in these types of treatment? Why wasn't it able to continue beyond the middle part of the 20th century?
Yeah. I think, again, that was a combination of things. The two key ones would have been the development of modern medicine, I suppose, through the latter half of the 19th century, the accessibility to proper medical services at home and in your local area. And then the second part would have been, I think, the kind of decline of the main clientele, which was the Anglo-Irish. So certainly after the First World War, it was used temporarily as an auxiliary hospital during the war, but essentially its clientele drifted away as well. But it's a pattern that was repeated in all the other Hydros around Britain. The European ones tended to last a little bit longer.
It's interesting to see the way the First World War disrupted things, because there were coal shortages and there was political upheaval, and that the outside world also had a massive impact.
Yeah, very much. And it was a kind of very poignant and telling thing that the last Turkish baths closed on the Hydro in 1916 because of the lack of coal, and never sort of reopened. I always think of somewhere like the Hydro as a kind of relational space. It connects to outside patterns and outside events, and then these are reflected internally, and that's how a place kind of absorbs wider trends and passions.
There's a golden age murder mystery called Knock, Murder, Knock, and it's mentioned in the book because it's written by Harriet Rutland, but it's it's based on St. Anne's Hill, but it's relocated to Devon and Hydro there. But it shows how it's also there in the popular culture as well.
Very much. And the author's real name was Olive Shimwell, and Sinead uncovered this great story. And essentially, the book is technically set in Devon, but she lived for 10 years or so in a cottage on the grounds of the Hydro. Her husband was a head brewer with Beamish's, and she essentially acutely observed everyday life in the Hydro and fed that back into the murder mystery. So even though on one level it might seem a slightly dubious historical source, it actually was based on genuine recording of life in the Hydro at that time, and lots of really lovely kind of stories and facts about how the Hydro was hierarchically organised in terms of class or whatever, and where the locals fitted in was part and parcel of that story.
Well, it's an excellent piece of historical scholarship. It's called Ireland's First Sanatorium, the St. Anne's Hill Hydro, County Cork, 1843 to 1953. The authors, Sinead McSweeney and Ronan Foley, and published by Four Courts Press as part of their wonderful Maynooth Studies in Local History series, published there in paperback. Ronan, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the invite.
We'll be back with the story of Joseph Conrad right after this. Well, welcome back. And to end the show tonight, we're delighted to be joined by Dr. Juliet Breton, who's a researcher and historian and an expert on depictions of Poland and Eastern Europe in English early 20th century literature, including the works of Joseph Conrad, to talk to us about the works of Conrad and the reasons for his profound suspicion of imperial power. Juliet, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Really excited to talk about this.
I think we often think about Conrad as a writer in English and these works like Heart of Darkness relating to imperialism, but I hadn't quite realised the background and how significantly Poland features in his background and his thinking. And I suppose even his very existence shows just how tricky the world was at that time, with Poland being partitioned and divided and disappearing from the map.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is often overlooked in Conrad's scholarship, in Conrad knowledge in England. And I think it's part of a bigger problem that we don't really, you know, in Britain, British thinking, we don't really think about Eastern Europe. In the West, I think Eastern Europe is a big blind spot. Conrad himself is this figure who is, you know, really in between different things. So he's obviously, he writes in English, he lives in Britain, but he obviously has this Polish background as well. And his heritage, I think, is such an important part of his literature, even though he doesn't write about Poland a lot. So we have some novels that are writing about Russia. So The Secret Agent is one big example, Under Western Eyes another example, and a couple of short stories about Poland. So he doesn't write about it very much. But in those stories and in his letters, you see this sustained interest in what it means to be Polish when your country has disappeared, and what it means to be Polish when you're in the West and you're facing discrimination, xenophobia, things like that. So I think it's a very important part of his writing that we do often overlook, yes.
So tell us about his background, because even now, like, he's seen as, what, a Polish-English writer, but born in what is now part of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I think we need to kind of go back in time here to roughly the 1790s. This is when the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, which is this sprawling entity across what's now Eastern Europe, so Belarus, Lithuania, Ukraine, Poland, this large entity disappears from the map. It's partitioned. The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth exists for several hundred years, but then the empires around it, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Prussian Empire, the Russian Empire, become more and more aggressive and start chipping away at the Commonwealth. And in the end, you know, it disappears. It's fully partitioned. This is about 50 years before Conrad is born, but he grows up in the wake of this. As you mentioned, he's born in a city which is now in Ukraine, but at the time he was born, it was in the Russian Empire. And this is an empire that is very anti-Polish, very repressive of Polish literature, language, culture. And Poles are very resistant to that. So you see several uprisings within the 19th century. some before and after Conrad is born, where Poles are trying to regain independence. But these uprisings fail and they're repressed. And two figures who are very prominent within these uprisings and within this Polish independence movement are Conrad's parents, particularly his father. So he grows up with this influence of, you know, romanticism, new nationalism, Polish independence, you know, trying to succeed in re-establishing the country that has been brutally dismembered by other empires. But it's also within this climate of failed uprisings. So he's really in between. I think I mentioned earlier about Conrad having these various influences on his life, but he's really in between romanticism, nationalism, and also a feeling of kind of a failure to regain Polish independence. So he grows up, his parents die when he's very young, so he ends up living with his uncle, who has a totally different idea of what Polish independence might be. His uncle believes Polish independence should be more to do with, well, actually less to do with the independence of the country itself, more to do with social growth and social improvement. So again, torn between ideas, the influence of his parents, the influence of his uncle. So he grows up within this kind of ghostly Poland, I think, this Poland where he feels Polish, he identifies as Polish, but he's growing up in a space that where Poland doesn't really exist and is repressed.
So tell me then about the Polish imagination of Conrad, because I think that background gives his writing a very different perspective when it comes to the Russian Empire, but perhaps empires in general.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And we can see this in his writing. I mentioned that he has some short stories about Poland, just a couple of stories. So one is Amy Foster. This is a very early story that he writes when he settles in England. He sort of joins the Navy and he's sailing, and then he decides to settle in England, not as a political decision, but really just to make money, to be able to have a bit of stability. He's quite bad with money. So he wants to have a bit of stability in England. And he starts writing in English. And this one of these first short stories he writes, Amy Foster, is about Eastern Europe. But it's not about Poland. It doesn't ever use the word Poland. It's more to do with kind of mountainous countryside landscape in the south, roughly now we would say maybe between the border of Poland and Ukraine. And it's a figure who, the protagonist is called Janko Gural. And so his name, Gural, comes from a mountain people called the Gurale, who are based in this region. But he doesn't have, this character doesn't have a sense of identity. And I think this is very much similar to Conrad at the time. So obviously he is influenced by Polish romanticism and Poland trying to regain independence, but also this weird position of being in exile, being in a repressed state, this kind of thing, and being, you know, writing in English and having this crisis of identity as well. So that's just one of the stories. And it really brings this perspective that we kind of need to read for Poland, need to read for Eastern Europe in his writing, beyond Russia, beyond colonialism, but also reading for a kind of diverse Eastern Europe. And that is Conrad's heritage.
And that really separates him from other writers in Britain at the same time who didn't have those direct insights into Russian political domination. And so their perspectives were quite different.
Absolutely. And I always think of this, there's a really fantastic story about when The Secret Agent is published in 1907. And one of Conrad's friends writes a review. This friend is called Edward Garnett, and he's married to Constance Garnett, who is a translator of Russian literature. And Garnett writes that, you know, Conrad brings the secrets of the Slavic soul and the Russian soul. And Conrad writes a letter in reply, and he's really angry. And he says, you know, you think that I'm a Russian, but I'm not. I'm a Pole. And your idea of history has been influenced too much by Russians. So this is Conrad really saying that he isn't, you know, a sort of writer within the Russian style. And this was a very popular style at the time. So I mentioned Constance Garnett. She's one of the writers and translators who are really bringing Russian literature into British literature at the time. So you see a wealth of interest in Russia, particularly in kind of rural depictions, national depictions. And Conrad is really rebelling against this and trying to show that Eastern Europe is not just Russia, and it's a very different, very diverse landscape. And he also writes to friends around the same time that he wants to make Polish life enter English literature. So it's a kind of quest for him to show English writers, British writers, that there's a very different perspective on Eastern Europe.
In Ireland, we're always very interested in the connection between Joseph Conrad and Roderick Casement and their experiences in the Congo and the influences on Heart of Darkness and so on. And I wonder, is there that empathy and connection between them precisely because of their backgrounds, that in a way Casement is also a kind of an exile and also as someone who has experienced the darker side of imperialism?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that there's also this parallel between the Polish experience and the Irish experience that, you know, we're dealing with two countries that there's a kind of loss of sovereignty, also Catholicism as well as a big parallel in between. So I think that where in England there is this xenophobia and this lack of understanding, I think in other countries, other places, there is more of a sympathy towards Poles. Whereas the English perspective, I think, is very much, you know, influenced by xenophobia, influenced by long-standing perceptions of Eastern Europe as somewhere distant, somewhere a bit scary, somewhere a little bit, you know, different from the West. So I think that there's certainly that influence goes, you know, into different channels, I think. I might also mention the French experience. There's a large Polish diaspora in France, for example, and in America. So I think those two countries also have a different experience of Polishness, different understanding of Polishness, purely because it's more integrated. Whereas the English experience is very often these perceptions of, you know, Poland is just Russia, is just, you know, distant and scary and different from the West.
And did that mean that some people in Britain viewed Conrad, maybe not quite with suspicion, but as something kind of different and as fundamentally alien to English literary culture because he was bringing these different insights and different perspectives and his fundamental mindset had been shaped by things they didn't quite fully appreciate or comprehend?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I think this is where we see a lot of critical perception. I mentioned about critics calling him a Slav or a Russian writer, but also critics who are really interested in his use of English. English is not Conrad's first or second language. He learns it in his 20s. So he's coming to the language new. He's coming to English writing influenced by French writing. So he spends some time in France, but also influenced by Polish traditional writing. So we can see in his writing these references to other texts, to Polish texts, to French texts, to different styles that I think for some English critics mean that his writing, it's a little bit like Marmite. Some people love it, some people hate it because it's so impressionistic and different, very modern style. But it does create this suspicion of him, I think, as well. And he struggles, you know, when he joins the Merchant Navy, he also struggles to assimilate. There are stories of him going to offices, and he has a very long Polish name. Kozieniowski is his original surname. And the English officials who look at his name comment that, you know, it has so many consonants and they can't really understand it. And so he really is in this very difficult position of not really belonging anywhere, but also maybe perhaps belonging everywhere.
And now, of course, his works are at the centre of the English literary canon, and he's seen as one of the great novelists in the English language. And probably most of the people who see him there don't quite appreciate this background and aren't aware of it and the complexities that come with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think this is a shame that we don't, in the West, we still don't have a lot of understanding about Eastern Europe, about Poland, despite quite sustained connections. So I'm thinking, you know, Britain and Poland, if we think to the Second World War, for example, we think about, you know, 1939, the Second World War, Britain joins, well, Britain is in support of Poland and Polish independence. And I think when we learn these facts and we, you know, we know of this in school or, you know, through the internet, and we sort of, we don't really think, well, hang on, that's a bit strange. Why is there this sustained interest? There always has been a connection between Britain and Poland, but I think it's often been eclipsed by Russia, by dominant imperial powers. And this is also something that